organisations, in particular the care of youth justice and policing, and she specialises in ethnographic methodologies. And today Anna's going to be sharing with us some of her recent work that has been an ethnography of remote Scottish islands.
Yes.
Alright?
Hello, I'm Anna. Thank you. Is it alright if I sit here? Do you need me to stand up or is it alright if I sit down? We don't need people that can't see you. You alright with me doing this?
Good.
That's awesome. I have got some pictures which are quite important. Can you see them? Can everyone see them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because this is going to be... I'm going to describe to you what it's like to be in a remote island. And the pictures are quite an important part of that. It's the nearest I can get to give you a sense of being there, other than bringing in an enormous wind machine. Right, so as long as you can see that, that's very useful. So I want to talk to you about my current research. I've recently spent a year living in the most remote islands of the UK, mostly in Shetland, which is here, but also the west of Wales. And I've been conducting an ethnographic study of policing and social control in the context of remote island life. And I've been working along police services and living in island communities and trying to work out how people maintain order when, in the words of Shetland locals, they're stuck on a rock, 220 miles by sea from the UK mainland. And I've been looking at what policing is when crime rates are low and when we have tiny and scattered populations, and who does it. And this is a huge project, and it's still ongoing, and it's kind of very much a work in progress. So one of the lovely things about coming here and meeting you all is I'd be really interested to know what you think. What I want to do today is give you a sense of the project, and in particular, what I've described this as criminology at the periphery. I want to talk about some of the challenges that this island environment creates for the way that we think in criminology, and particularly I want to talk about some of the limitations of our conceptual vocabulary. So I'm talking through about kind of why I think this is an issue. But first of all, just to explain that, I know we have one Scottish colleague here. We've got any other Scots? Hi, where are you from?
I'm originally from Glasgow, but I studied in Edinburgh.
Okay, right.
I'm from Oban.
Okay, right. Some of this might be a little bit interesting. So there is a policy problem in the background of this project, which is one of the things that's furthering on here, which is in 2013, we previously had 8 Scottish police services, and they were all amalgamated into one, so we've got a single national police service now in Scotland called Police Scotland. And this created a kind of ongoing debate about the problems between centralisation and localism, in policing in particular, but generally about the delivery of criminal justice services. And one of the things that's particularly unusual about Scotland is its diversity in its landscapes. You have huge urban populations like Glasgow or Edinburgh, and tiny little islands of 30 people. So, with previous police services, at least you have the opportunity for some specialism there. So the Highlands and Islands, the areas which I'm going to be talking about, used to be covered by a Northern Constabulary. And I've heard quite a lot over the last few years about the difference of Northern Constabulary in the way it operated to other urban police services. I don't know if that's true, but there's been quite a lot of stories about that and about the way they work with communities and so on. So the question then, the policy question is, how can a single police service respond and adapt and understand the needs of their local communities? So does everything become absorbed into the most powerful part of the police service? In other words, does all policing become like Glasgow? And in the first years of Police Scotland, the arguments were this is exactly what was happening. People talked about the Strathclydeisation of policing throughout Scotland. So I was interested in exploring that and thinking about if this was the case, what are those tensions and how are they experienced by local people and by police officers in the most remote parts of Scotland. So Shetland is where I've done most of my work, and I think this is particularly interesting because of where it is. So there's Shetland, there. It's the most remote archipelago in the UK. It's 220 miles by sea from Aberdeen, that's the main transport link. And to get there, you get on a boat, and it takes at least 12 hours, if you're lucky. The longest I've heard it take is 36 hours because of the weather. It's a very physical journey. If anyone goes to Shetland by that boat, which I really recommend that you do because it's amazing, my biggest tip in all this research is check the shipping forecast before you order anything from the canteen. I can tell you that from experience. It's also a very expensive journey. It costs about £300 each way, so it's cheaper to go to New York from Edinburgh than it is to go to Shetland. When you're there, you're almost as close to Norway as you are to the Scottish mainland. The story that we're always told is that the nearest train station is Bergen. So that's where I did most of my research. I also did some research just here, the strip of islands here. which is called the Outer Hebrides, or West, probably called the Western Isles. And they are 60 miles from the northwest coast of Scotland. So the reason I found Shetland interesting, these islands interesting, is because obviously they're physically at the periphery of East Scotland's territory, but they're also at the periphery of the dominant model of what we think about in terms of policing and police work and how it's organised. So very simply, if you think about police work as organised around ideas about crime, that is challenged in environments where you have very tiny populations and very low crime rates. And the structure of policing and police resources doesn't fit with the things that we know are challenging about remote and rural policing, so large distances, isolated offices and so on. But islands are particularly interesting and complicated because they have very peculiar dynamics. So islands are both connected to a larger mainland, where they're normally economically and politically subordinate to them, and they're isolated enough to see themselves as distinctive, and for others to see them as distinctive too. And what happens in that kind of combination of dynamics is it results in very distinctive forms of local identity in islands, which are often rooted in opposition to the mainland. So if you go to Shetland, for example, one of the main features of Shetland life is a display of not Scottishness. So buildings are, you can see that there, they're purposely built on a Scandinavian model. This is the policy for social housing. They're wooden, they have to be brightly coloured. You will find flags everywhere, which are Shetland flags, purposely not Scottish flags, which you see on all public buildings elsewhere in Scotland. And the biggest cultural event, which I'll talk a little bit about later, in Shetland, is the Viking ceremony of Up Pelliar, where essentially, describing this in one sentence, men dress up as Vikings and set fire to boats. That's basically what it's about. But what it pretends to be about is a celebration and reaffirmation of Norse heritage in Shetland. So this kind of sense of difference and Norse heritage is fiercely protected, and in the context of a single police service, I thought that was really interesting. Particularly as what Police Scotland has also done is open up opportunities for police officers from all over Scotland to go and work in anywhere they like. So Shetland Police Force is made up of Glasgow, Edinburgh, Central Belt police officers. So that was the kind of policy problem. Islands are also at the periphery of what we think about as criminological researchers. So I think that we have also absorbed the diversity of experience into dominant ideas of urban life. So what I want to argue today is that assumptions of urban place invest everything that we think about. There are very few studies of non-urban life, and when they are, we see them as somehow atypical. So we talk about a kind of rural difference, which is positioned against an urban norm. And this is very clear in police research, where our conceptual development that underpins police scholarship is all based on studies of policing in cities. So, for example, I'm going to talk a bit about police culture today. We know that police culture is usually important in thinking about policing and how, in other words, for those who don't work in this field, we're interested in how the pressures of police work shapes the way that police officers think about their social world and their role in it, and how that shapes what they do. And this has been recognised now as a hugely important idea in how we think about police practice and how we think about reform. And as Peter Waddington argued, this is one of the few concepts which also has affected how police officers think about themselves. It's been one of the kind of background stories that shape what they actually do. But the way we derive that concept has come from these urban ethnographies. And we've translated those, we've looked at how those pressures are kind of translated into practice purely through looking at policing in cities. So for example, we've come to recognise as elements of police culture, things which actually describe urban life. So we talk about how police prioritise ideas of action and excitement. There's a particular understanding of a drive for efficiency, for results. And an understanding of relationships with the public is kind of characterised by hostility and isolation and a sense of kind of us and them. And anything other than that we see as either acultural or atypical, or we just don't notice it at all. So my drive for doing this research was, what if all our foundational work had been done in places like this? What would we think was important? What would our cultural concepts look like? And what work might we notice that we currently don't see? So by taking myself out to a different context that's so different to urban life, I'm trying to explore the blind spots in the way that we think. And this is in a kind of vein of studies which are in anthropological studies and natural science research as well, where islands are seen as laboratories, where people go and try and test the limits of mainstream ideas by taking themselves off into these kind of slightly strange environments. And what I want to talk about today is a range of phenomena which I think become important in understanding how islands work and how policing works within that. And I think it does show some of the limitations of the way that we think. So I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about, first of all, these are all broadly grouped about ideas of environment and place. I want to talk first of all about remoteness. And is this going to be setting the scene about island life and talking about why place matters, not just because of how we distribute our resources, our people and so on, and not just because of logistical problems, although those really do matter, but talking about how people sense, how the environment shapes people's sense of where they are and what that means for how communities live in themselves. So I'll talk about that first. And then I also want to talk about policing as a kind of islands of conceptual lens for understanding policing, particularly looking at the way that policing moves. And finally, I want to go on briefly again to talk about some of the things that I think that we miss currently as criminologists, and particularly I want to think about scum. Okay? So those will be the three things that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk largely about data. I'm going to show you a lot of photos. But first of all, what I'll do is, I don't know, has anyone here ever been to Shetland or the Western Isles? Okay. Okay. I assume most people wouldn't. So what I want to do is just tell you a little bit about kind of where they are and what they look like. So this here is Shetland, and on the left is the Western Isles. It's not a scale. The Western Isles from top to bottom is about 180 miles. And Shetland from top to bottom is about 75 miles. I chose two places. Most of my work's been in Shetland as my primary site, and the Outer Hebrides, or Western Isles, has been my comparison. And that's because of this question of the distinctiveness of island identity. I wanted to see what the continuities were, but also what the differences were. And there are some similarities. So the populations are about the same in both. Both have about 23,000 people, Western Isles slightly more. In both, populations clustered in the town, so Lerwick, I haven't got a pointer, but Lerwick is two-thirds of the way up, and at the top Stornoway, you can just see there. So those are the main towns in both places. Is that pointing?
No.
Okay, go on.
Oh!
Hey, well, I did. Come on. Okay. Okay, that's technical. Yes, so I don't want to do that. Okay, never mind, I'll just point. That's easier. They have similar crime rates, which are very low, and they have similar kinds of issues. So there's a lot of stuff which you get anywhere you put groups of people together, ordinary, everyday type of crime. So things like antisocial behaviour, domestic abuse, thefts. So someone, a police officer, said to me, we're dealing with the same stuff here, just in a little bit lesser degree. When you're in a house here, you could be in the East End of Glasgow or Edinburgh or Inverness. It's the same stuff people are coming out with, just in a different accent. But actually, there is something very unusual about island crime, which is its enormous range. So officers deal with this kind of ordinary stuff, but they also deal with wildlife crime, maritime crimes. There is a lot of substance abuse, so generally alcohol in the Western Isles and drugs in Shetland. Historically, Shetland has been the target for organised crime gangs, so there's some heroin based kind of organised crime in Shetland. And both of them have potential for very serious incidents indeed. So they've got both got commercial airports and ferry ports. In the Western Isles, there's a Ministry of Defence base. In Shetland, there's Sullom Voe, which is the largest oil and gas terminal in Europe. There are, however, very significant and obvious differences in both of them, and these are largely cultural. So in Shetland, sort of show you, there's a very strong emphasis on Norse heritage. They've had a different background. There's no clans in Shetland, for example. In the Western Isles, it's different. It's based, It's based largely around Gaelic culture and identity, and particularly around religion. So you still, it's Protestant in the north and gets Catholic towards the bottom. And in the north, there's a very strong emphasis on protecting, on respecting the Sabbath. So it's still one of the very few places left in the UK where everything's shut on a Sunday. You're not supposed to go to parks, you can't wash your car, you're not supposed to jog, and most of all, you don't hang your washing out on a Sunday. And that's because washing is visible to your neighbours. So if you hang your washing out, you're making a statement about your lack of respect to the community, to the people around you. And it's still the case that you'll get angry letters through your door if you do that, or people will take your washing down. And for many, that idea has become disconnected from religion. It's actually become about identification with the island and about respecting the island. And so it's fiercely protected. Another difference is about kind of wealth and success, that Shetland is a wealthy island. It has an oil industry, but mostly it has a very large fishing industry. And the small island Walther, which is just where it's a school there, that's where the main fishing families are. And it's often said that there are more millionaires per square mile than anywhere else in the UK. Luckily for the fishing men, there are lots of myths and superstitions about it being bad luck for women to go on fishing boats. So the wealth is just not evenly distributed. It is very much very gendered roles in the population. This is also true in the Western Isles, where the Western Isles Council is called Corlin Antlin Shia. Has 80 councillors and all of them are men. So there's some very traditional gender roles which are being challenged to different degrees in both islands. In Shetland there's full employment. Workers come in to fish and come in to do the oil work. So it's much more cosmopolitan than Western Isles. There are pockets of deprivation, but the isle as a whole has money. The roads are very good. Every island has a swimming pool and a sports centre on it. The Western Isle does not have that. Crofting is still important. The main industry is tourism, so it's seasonal and it's precarious, and it's having a detrimental effect on communities which are not surviving with the seasonal kind of change. There's something interesting physically different about them too, which is the Western Isles has causeways between, it's still only two ferries to go across the whole stretch, but the smaller islands, the bottom half here, have causeways between them, which means that you can drive from one island to another. And Shetland doesn't. The island is separated by sea. There's a whole series of smaller peripheral islands around the edge. So they have physical boundaries and distinctive identities. They see themselves as different. Other people see them as different. They're marketed as different. And there are real differences in organisation too. So the biggest contrast to me is there's a tiny little line called Fair Isle at the bottom, which is on that map, and one called Fula at the side here. Both of them have about 30 to 50 people in their population. They're not on the national grid, they have no power after midnight. You can only get there by little planes or by very sick-making fishing boats. I think I've got a picture of Fuller Airport. Right? Yeah, that's Fuller Airport. And what's very interesting is that Fair Isle is a thriving tourist destination. It's been the subject of a BBC documentary. Fuller is described by all Shetlanders as broken, as a shithole full of mad people. And what sums it up for me is that both islands have this incredible bird life and nature. And in particular, they have these colonies of Arctic skuas, which are called bonksies in the Shetland dialect. And the Fair Isle have capitalised on this, and they've created a bed and breakfast, it's got a bird observatory, they've made it a tourist destination. And in Fuller, the only thing that you can buy or hire on the island is a stick to hit the birds with. But the other thing which I think is important for this talk is that I'm going to talk mainly about Shetland because of something else about this geography. Because islands are separated, you can only get on them or off them by ferries. So at night when the ferries stop, the islands are cut off, firstly. But secondly, what that means is that everyone knows where you are at all times. Because the ferryman has seen you, it's always a ferryman, the ferryman has seen you get on a ferry. And the scrutiny is incredibly intense. So the ferryman said to me, I know every person, every child, every dog. And it's true. Where there is more movement in the Western Isles, the scrutiny is less intense. So it can be incredibly complicated to live there. So just to give you an example, I went to the Isle of Yell for the first time one February in the dark to work with the local police officer that works there. And I went and just had a kind of quick chat with him and hung around for a couple of hours. And I went back over a month later. And he was on rest days. He was the only person I knew on the island. I moved into a little cottage. I bought a bottle of water. That was literally it. And by the evening, he phoned me up to say his neighbour had said to him the exact words, "I see Anna's back on the island again." So they knew my name, and you were there to see him, and you had been there before. So you are in this intense sort of scrutiny. The other significant thing about Shetland is you're much more cut off from the mainland. In the Western Isles, you can see the mainland. So you have more routes off. And I think that makes a really important difference to how islanders feel and how they organise themselves. Someone said to me, you know, it's a remote, but it's a nice remote. I know I can get to my mum's in the afternoon, my mum's on the mainland if I need to. So Shetland has really got these exaggerated dynamics of some of the issues to do with remote islands. So I'm mainly going to talk about Shetland today. Just quickly tell you something about policing. Both islands have got about 38 offices in them. In Shetland, there's no specialist units in both islands. All officers do everything from start to finish. And there's also no custody staff, which is one of the biggest kind of issues there. So if you lock someone up, you arrest someone, that's the officers taken off shift. And that strongly affects their decision making. As an officer said, you know, you do not look to lock people up. If you lock someone up for being a bit of a dick, that's your whole shift taken up. So people generally try and de-escalate. Most of the officers in both places are based in the town. That's the big circle there. And that's to do with historical processes of centralisation in Ireland generally. In Shetland, there's only one officer who works the whole of the North Isles. They've resisted it a little bit in the Western Isles, which is partly to do with distance, about it being 180 miles long, but also wider sort of social factors outside. The policing has led the process of centralisation to be less acute. The biggest difference in policing in the islands is in the Western Isles, all the officers are local. Most of them, anyway, are local. In Shetland, almost none of them are local. They've all transferred in. And again, that's because there's no tradition of local policing in Shetland. Over the last few decades, I think there's been one Shetland officer. But also because it's a much harder prospect, for reasons which I will make clear today. Officers don't know each other in the two island groups. There's no travel between them, but they share a radio station. So they tell stories about what it must be like in the other island places, which I find really interesting. And they do kind of learn about the world from each other. The Shetland officers heard an assault of Nossa in the Western Isles on real time through the radio. I think that had quite a significant impact on them. So what I did is I spent most of my time just going on shifts with the police. And I did this across different times of policing, across different seasons, which was very important because Shetland, a night shift at Shetland in summer when there is practically no dark, is a very different prospect from a night shift at Shetland in December. So I wanted to see what that was like. And across islands as well, because the towns are, you know, what I discovered very early on is that remoteness is relative. For people living in the peripheral islands, the towns are not remote at all. They are considered urban centres. People have felt to be that communities are relatively anonymous, and policing seem like that too. So in one of the smaller islands in the Western Isles, the officer was complaining about the stowaway boys coming down here and ruining all my work. Because they're big kind of, you know, macho police officers. So I'm going to talk mainly today about smaller islands. And I also spent quite a lot of time just trying to understand what it's like to live and work in Shetland too, and also to be police. And I did that in various ways. First of all, thought that what I would do is talk to people who were thought by the police or others to be problematic. I wanted to see what that was like. But actually, it just became easy to talk to everyone. The islands, communities have little community councils, so I could go and meet them through there. And just very kind of easily snowballs. And I could follow stories through as they became important. So one of the biggest stories was about the most surprising thing was the politics of the Upphaliar Viking festival, which has become a real lightning rod in Shetland at the moment. So quite a lot of work. I went to 8 festivals and ended up host-guessing one of them, which was another story for another time. But the best insight was just from living in Shetland. It is without question the most wonderful and extraordinary research I have ever done. And also without question the hardest research I've ever done. I, like officers, experienced intense loneliness and intense darkness and intense scrutiny. I will talk about those dynamics in a minute, but for now, I'll just say, if you want to escape, you do not escape to a remote island. If you want to escape, go to London. Every moment of your life as a new person is observed. You're watched through binoculars as you walk through the island. It's kind of quite a strange experience. So what this means as an ethnographer, as John van Marlen has said, that in ethnography there's always the risk of exclusion and embarrassment. And this was multiplied to a million degrees. It was a very useful process of learning how you become accepted into a small island community like this. Top tip for anyone ever wants to do this research, the turning point for me was going to, I lived in the South Mainland of Shetland for a while, and they had a weekly dance at the local social hall, which the social hall is one of the most important community institutions. There's a little shop sometimes, and there's a hall where you can have a dance or drink, or there's a roving Chinese takeaway that comes about once a month for boys. And in the summer, it's a very strong culture of volunteering. There are Sunday teas where people bring their china and they'll raise money, get a super sweet for £5, it'll go towards building a mural or something. And I thought, this is before the Nutpenny Art Festival, and I thought I need to learn how to do these dances, and there was a dance, weekly dance club. And I got very anxious about it because this was, of course, something for the community. I was on my own, and I had to ask someone to dance with me, which meant that they weren't dancing with the person they were with, which could disrupt all kinds of relationships. The first time I went, I was so nervous, I just sat in my car and sweated, and I couldn't go in. And the next week I did go in. And I discovered you get a little kind of grilling over the St. Rona's walls. You know, it was always the same way. You know, what are you up? Are you on holiday? Or no one here for a while? Who are you with? In other words, who's your husband? Doing some work. And they said, do you work in a hospital? Because those are the kind of traditional gender roles for incomers. But it was great because everywhere I went after then, I knew everybody because I had danced with them. And so this is my biggest top tip for you if you want to do research. Learn how to do the Boston two-step. So that's kind of what the context of the research was like. Gradually during this period, I learned how to piece together how communities work and how policing works within that. So I'm going to start off talking about some of the issues about this, so what it's like to be this the social organisation of islands. And what I want to show you is this is to try and understand that. This is really inextricable with the physical environment too. So, okay, so talking about remoteness, the first thing to say about the use of the word remoteness is that this is my externally imposed definition. There's a very strong theme in the work here about whether the islands are remote or not. So are you remote if you can order things from Amazon? Are you remote if you have the people you love around you? Here is your world. People talked about the islands as living in an extended family, which was also my experience of it. Are you remote if you're connected by Facebook? Remoteness is certainly not about being connected by sea, surrounded by sea, rather. Sea actually gives a very strong sense of connectedness. Seas bring boats, they bring people, they bring animals, they're interesting. Something happens, something new happens every day. In the local newspaper, the Shetland Times, they report which boats have come in. It's all quite interesting. So when I was feeling very lonely, I would go down to the sea, and the seals come out and look at you, and you can take them for a walk. They're just like dogs. And it's a very kind of connecting thing rather than a cutting off thing, mostly. Remoteness is also a positive thing for many people. It's creative, it gives a sense of robustness and a sense of identity. So for many people, those who are struggling with remoteness, so transferees for example, that's something that marks them out as an outsider. So I think I've got an Isles officer here who's a local saying, people ask, what do? People can't imagine it. They feel they miss out on so many things. They've got so many things they think they need to have, but they really don't. The only downside, he said, is that you have to check whether you're related when you're dating someone. So it's a strong, resilient kind of concept. It also stops problems coming in, which I'll talk about a bit later on. It stops people coming in you don't want to come in. You can, if someone is fired from a job, for example, if for criminal behaviour, they get kind of exiled, they go off island, is the phrase. It stops drugs coming in, mostly. And it stops problematic ideas coming in, including ideas about policing, which we'll talk about in a bit. There is also a sense of separation about being out of sight, which is a very can allow people to have a very powerful form of resistance, which is also very important, as I'll show you in a bit about policing. But remoteness is also fundamental to community organisation. So despite all the positive, and I think strongly, properly felt expressions of positive stuff about remoteness, it's also a problem there in the background. And mostly, the problem is about being stuck. It's very difficult to get off the island of Shetland, and that's not only because of the distance and because of the lack of transport, but about something physical where people live. And the reason it's difficult to plan and it gives people a sense of being stuck is because of the weather. So someone says here, you know, the weather makes it could be the best place to live or the worst place to live. The one thing that separates it is the weather. Now, the islands from where they are subject to intense weather systems. So 50 mile an hour winds is normal. People say, hang on, washing out in 50 mile an hour winds. I once got blown off my feet. Actually, I had to hang on to something. I think that was 80 miles an hour. They also have this black fog that comes down. And this is, the weather is fundamentally important to island life. Flights get cancelled, ferries can't sail. People can't travel on or off islands. And that's whether you want to see your family or whether there's delivery of food to Tesco's. Tesco's is the main supermarket, often it's empty. Or whether it's any other officers coming to support you or back you up. And during bad weather, you get isolated in other ways, as you don't have any mobile phone signal, police radios don't work, there are frequent power cuts. And that really reinforces people's sense of being somewhere that is stuck. It's physical remoteness, you're stuck out in the North Sea, there's that feeling of remoteness. And what became particularly important about this, and I want to talk about this now because I'll pick it up at the end, is darkness became important. Everybody talks about darkness, islands and offices. So this is an officer talking about the practical limitations. Are you okay? He's saying, you know, there are no street lights, it's pitch black, it's the darkest place I've ever been, I couldn't find the bastard house. And it is pitch black, you cannot see anything. In Shetland people call it the black dark, and I've never experienced darkness like it. It's the only time since being a very little child that I've actually been frightened of the dark. And again, that reinforces a sense of isolation. So this is an officer saying, people who look at it don't understand your darkness. Here, there is nothing. And so this is a way, I think, just mention this now, that this is a way in which the environment tells people about where they are. Why this is important to policing is that this is a constant uncertainty in the background of how they work. They're very likely to be stranded and alone. People are stranded all the time during my research. At the same time, they know that they're isolated and that no one's coming to support them. So they don't have firearms or road traffic or land response vehicles. We don't have that support. If something happens, it's just us. We don't have 6, 7, 8 police cars that just show up. We're stuck and we're remote. There's also a theme that they repeated, which is about being not just being physically stuck, but about being forgotten by Police Scotland and being abandoned, and not being understood, that no one understands what this environment is like for us. And inevitably, this shapes the way officers work, kind of de-escalation because they don't know they're going to have backup, a need to rely on the communities in case you do get stuck, so there's kind of forging strong relationships and so on. I'll come back to policing in a bit, but for now, what I want to say is this is also true for communities. What this means for communities is that relationships become hugely important. That communities are not only are potentially stuck where they are, marooned, if you like, which means they're very interdependent and they're very vulnerable for fear of disruption. So I'll show you what this is like. And all of this is from the small islands in Shetland, where I think the dynamics are most noticeable, most important. So the first thing people told me everywhere I went in Shetland is you have to be careful what you say to people here. So these are worries. You're going to be living with people for a long time, so you really don't want to. You can't be so aggressively assertive about your opinions because you know you can't get away from them. And what people do is they form very finely grained maps of social connections to know what you can say to people so you don't offend them. So the first thing people say is, "Was it folk?" Which means who's your folk, who's your people, And you might say, if you're from Shetland, you'll say, my mother's from Bray, my uncle runs the Cunningsborough Garage. And by kind of slotting you into a map, they'll realise they know who you are and what you can say and what you can't say. I mean, I was very interested by the amount of fancy dress in Shetland, not only at the LAR, but in kind of, they have something called a party bus where everyone dresses up and goes out and gets drunk. He travels around the island on a bus. And I think the fancy dress is important because it allows people the freedom to behave as they want without any inhibitions. It actually kind of takes them away from this scrutiny for a while. So this kind of sense of fragility actually brings about a real wariness, Laurie, that people talk to incomers. Isn't it? It can be a real shit of a place for anybody coming in, you just get ignored. And this isn't because of hostility. On the whole, incredibly warm, friendly communities. It's about a fear of how are you going to be all right? Are you going to disrupt this community? So the question asked about newcomers, and even in the police, particularly with transferees coming in, is what are they running away from? Why are they here? And what that means is, what is the problem that I need to anticipate that these people might disrupt the dynamic of community life? And of course, there are some community figures who are more potentially disruptive than others. And this, of course, includes the policeman or a doctor. It's always a policeman. The Shetland for woman is wife. So that's how you call woman. And so I actually heard a woman, a female police officer, be described as a wife policeman. So policeman or a doctor. And because communities are isolated, they're also quite inward-looking, because they're interested in what's happening. And also, as well as kind of working out if there's any potential threats, it's also quite interesting. Someone said to me, it's not malicious, someone said to me, you know, we're not nosy, we're just newsy, which I think is probably about right. It's a hard place to have secrets. I was told that people's binoculars by their windows aren't for bird watching, which I thought they were. They're actually for just looking at a car you didn't know, which is basically a car you don't know. Look at them through your binoculars. So there's a lot of gossip and there's a lot of exaggeration. So the North Isles police officer said when he first arrived, he realised that he needed to really forge some relationships. And islands had previously been punishment postings. No one wanted to go there. So in the old regime, people would get kind of posted to an island, a small island, if you'd done something wrong. So it's quite a kind of history of conflict. And so he knew that he really ought to tell people. He chose to be there. He was really pleased to be there. So he went into the doctor's surgery. He was talking to the receptionist. And he said, I'm really excited to be here. Six officers applied for my job. And the next day he was told by a neighbour, I hear 67 officers applied for your job. So there is a Shetland phrase, which is, you fart in some room, you shit yourself by the time you get to bed. Which is just showing that this is just the way the islands work. And if you do shit yourself, you'll never be allowed to forget it, because islands have long memories. So I was told about the time a fisherman was stabbed a few years ago. A few years ago was 1981. So, and this is, I don't mean to kind of, I think this is funny, and islanders laugh at this too. So this isn't kind of, to mock them. This is genuinely something which I think is hilarious about Shetland life, which they also find hilarious about Shetland life. And again, like I said, it's not malicious. But regardless, it's a very, very powerful tool of social control. And it's reinforced by two central features of Shetland life. And the first is the Shetland Times. Now, in an island of 23,000 people, there are two newspapers and three radio stations just about Shetland. The Shetland Times is extraordinary. It lists in excruciating detail every misdemeanor of everybody. So they write word for word what's said in court. The sheriff says that he read it to find out what he said. And the other thing is the Upheliar Viking ceremony, which is actually a ceremony for what is supposed to be about Norse heritage. It's about lots of things, but actually what it's about is it's a ceremony of shaming. The first thing that happens is a bill is put up the first day in Shetland. And people have been writing this secretly throughout the year. And in dialect, it lists all the embarrassing things that have happened in the community over the last year in Ryan. And it's hilariously funny, it's full of jokes. And afterwards, there's a party in the social halls where teams of men in fancy dress called squads will act out sketches about these embarrassing things. If you do something wrong, it will be on a 10-foot-high billboard. And 20 men in fancy dress will dress up as you and do a dance about what you've done in front of all of your neighbours. So this is very effective. If you do something wrong, it will be noticed, and it will be exaggerated, and it will be spread, and those stories aren't going anywhere. So this is used against the police too. So just kind of for now, a question which I'm thinking about, which is, what is the role of the police in a system like this? Now, mostly, I was told, the island polices itself. This has been a really interesting thing to observe. There are lots of demonstrations of showing the police officer that the power is on the islanders' own terms. So this is just a little excerpt of field notes on one of the small islands. The officer goes into one of the hotels on the small islands, and the officer says, you know, any issues. And this is the hotel manager, S. He says, few doors have been blown open in the wind. What do you mean by that? Someone's broken in. One of us says, learning being blown away. It's all done in this kind of... And Bess says, you know, roof tiles, a bit of lead. He then says, you know, what happens in the island stays on the island. If we can find it, we will. In other words, I'm letting you know that I'm not asking for your help. So it's a very interesting little kind of moments where the islanders say, this is not for you. There's a kind of a game sometimes played. So when the police officer leaves the island, the ferryman will phone the pubs and say, that's the officer off the island, so everyone can drink and go. When you are queuing with a police car waiting to get on the ferry, someone will send a photograph of the police van to the islanders' WhatsApp chats and say, the police are coming. And there's actually an officer from one of the small islands who is on the WhatsApp chat where she got sent a photograph of herself by the van saying the police are coming. So it's a very kind of game, a little dance that they will play with each other. Now the police are wanted, however. Islander says, you know, just because we're on an island, we're not outside the law. More generally, I mean, there is crime that needs the police, sometimes it's a very serious crime. And more generally, the police are there as a symbol of state authority. There's the potential, they have the potential for authoritative intervention. In other words, just to keep people in order just by being there. Someone said, you know, we need someone in the aisle keeping a lid on a can of worms. We need a police presence. They don't need to do much, they just need a presence. However, this is acceptable only within a very tightly constrained sort of set of conditions. So, like any small community that's worried about dying out, what they want is any new arrival to come and settle. So, what we want is the story about this officer is he wants to settle, he chose to be here, that's appreciated. And they want them to integrate, not only the officer, but also their wife, their husband too, and particularly they want them to have kids, so it keeps the school going. These are really important things for a community. But there is, when there is... things are unsuccessful. Communities feel burnt by past experiences, police, particularly in the background of punishment postings. So talking about four officers, a sneak, he didn't live there, he came in to creep about, in other words, he didn't integrate properly. So the risk, if officers get this wrong, is a withdrawal of consent. Now, the island won't put up with people coming in and trying to change the place the way they think it should be. That's an islander saying that. Now, this isn't generally by violence, like you might see with withdrawals of consent elsewhere. That's not impossible. I was told about 30 years ago, there was two officers in the little station of Barra in the south bit of the Outer Hebrides were barricaded inside the police station by angry locals. And it's been known as the Siege of Barra. I can't get anyone to tell me whether this actually happened or not, but it's a good story. In Shetland and elsewhere in the West Isles, actually, it's mostly much more subtle than that. What happens is you're frozen out. So if they don't like you, this is an islander talking, if they don't like you, they won't talk to you, even in the shop. And the shops are really important because it's the only social institution, the only place where everyone goes. Even in the shop, they won't talk to you. I've seen people treated like that. It's like... Now, if you are a police officer, that makes it very difficult for you to do your job. People close up around you. But also you have to manage hostility in your everyday life and your family too. I actually interviewed a couple who lived in a small island in Shetland who had been for misdemeanours to do with Shetland life. They had been made unwelcome in every social institution. And in an island of 50 people, that's a very uncomfortable place to be. And it was felt very clearly by officers as well. This has bearing on the kids. Kids were getting a hard time. So this is an officer in a small island, actually in the Western Isles. He's saying, almost every call I go to, I know the people, I know the sun. It makes you conscious of how you deal with everything. It makes you very conscious your reputation's on the line. On the mainland, you could be short with a member of the public and cross with them because of the volume of work. Here you could get away with it. Here you only do that once, and he was rude to me. No matter how tired you are, you have to provide a service on the island. It not only affects my reputation, but my wife's as well. So this environment creates a very kind of particular set of dynamics, and there are real differences in the way that officers behave here to the way that they behave in city centres. Some do it incredibly well, they're transparent, they leave the light on the police station when they're on duty, for example, and they turn it off when they're not on duty. They say, only tell me what you want me to know, don't tell me things you don't want me to know. They navigate their way through this. People also talk about de-escalation, and this isn't just because you're going to get stuck by the weather, it's conscious of these dynamics in the background. So it's about keeping relationships calm and about forging strong community relationships. And I think this idea that this is about policing by consent is a really interesting one, because it asks the question, what's happening in Glasgow or Edinburgh or wherever these officers have actually come from? How do they understand that issue? But I think what they're trying to capture here is some of the kind of fragility of the power relationships. Now, I haven't got much space here to talk about what policing becomes in this, but I just want to make a couple of points. But first of all, I think this is community policing, but not as we understand it from classic police studies, Banton and so on. This isn't what I think about it as a difference between sort of thick interventionist community policing, but this is actually something much thinner. It's about being there, being a presence, but not intervening unless you're actually asked to, which is problematic. But secondly, this is a much more fragile idea of police power than, again, classic police studies talk about. So this is not so much about a police officer working on the norms of community, keeping power in reserve, and so on, which obviously is that. But there's something much more precarious here, I think. There's about a kind of mutual negotiation of order. And it seems to me that actually what people have been describing has got much more in common with work by Richard Sparks and colleagues on power relationships in prison and how people negotiate those. But thirdly, I just want to come back now to this question of culture. Are the ways that officers try and negotiate these kind of issues, do they reflect something substantially different about island policing? Are they simply a set of adaptive strategies here to cope with their environment? Or do these environments produce a different way of thinking about policing? And I think there's something really quite complicated going on here. And I'm starting to think about this as a kind of idea of archipelago. So the way I've started to use islands is not just as a kind of context, as a place where this happens, but actually as a conceptual lens as well, and a way of thinking about variation and complexity in police culture, for example. And one of the things that we miss in the work that we do about police culture is that policing travels. People travel. They transfer in and out of very different areas, particularly in Police Scotland now, with officers transferring from central belt cities to these tiny little islands and moving backwards and forwards for courses and that kind of thing. And ideas about policing travel too. So I was very struck by the way that officers from the mainland use the term down the road. And down the road sometimes means the mainland, sometimes it means city policing, sometimes it means police Scotland generally. But it implies a kind of connectedness to some other place, a kind of nomadic experience. So these officers in Shetland are in a strange position of kind of being down the road 200 miles by sea. And I found this concept of archipelago very helpful. It's been used in island studies a bit more now to move away from the traditional binaries in the way that people have thought about islands, where you've got land, sea, mainland, island. But it it shows kind of flows and interconnectedness between islands. So it draws the attention, people are using it to draw the attention to a kind of fluidity of cultural processes and this idea of kind of metamorphosis. So the way that ideas or culture or language changes and takes on a slightly different inflection each new place it travels to. So it's not straightforward cloning, but it emerges in its own terms. Now this doesn't mean, of course, that traditional cultural concepts don't exist in Ireland, but I think there's a process of change and translation as officers engage in these new environments. It's something very subtle. And what you can do by seeing those kind of processes of change and travel is what the core ideas of policing are, the thing that remains. And I think there's a very interesting example of this. It's kind of inescapable in the islands, which is this. It's one of the most depressing things that Police Scotland has done, as I discovered through this research, is changed how people think about what policing is. And this is how people talk about Police Scotland. It was imposing an enforcement culture about volumes of tickets, volumes of stop and searches. And of course, Scottish policing has come into a lot of trouble in a way that people weren't about getting these volumes. But it's about, I was heartbroken, people saying, when Police Scotland came in, it was terrible. They tried to Glasgow Scotland, they became obsessed with stats and targets. It was stats. It wasn't even a gaffer wanting their pips, it was from high up. So it was entirely about enforcement, and the story about the islands, some of the reasons why people said they went to the islands, was to get away from that. The story was, this can't happen here. It would be ridiculous in this context. So can you imagine being a cop in Chapman being told you've got to get 3 tickets a day and destroy everything? Why don't they all have to just laugh and say, no, I'm not doing that up. But someone said, you know, you can drive the length of the island and not pass a single car. How can you give out car tickets? You know, it's a fair point. And this is one of the ways which remoteness helps resistance, stops things coming in, I'm told. That's not true, however. What Police Scotland has done, this is what I mean by being destructive, is it's changed the conceptual vocabulary about thinking about policing. It's removed any other idea of what a productive officer looks like. So officers who want to be promoted in the islands, who want to show they're doing a good job, still want to try and get tickets. We don't like doing it, but otherwise it looks like you're sitting on your arse all day. They've got no other way of showing that they're busy. They adopt some quite creative strategies. And even when there's a difference between Shetland, where this is very acute, and Western Isles, where it's perhaps less so, which might be to do with the volume of transferees, it might be to do with local management, I think, in Shetland. But even the Western Isles people deny they have to do it. Never had to do it, never had that, never as Northern, never as Police Scotland, never need to show we're busy. What's significant is that this is how you show you're busy, is you show that you've got tickets and stats on your workload. And this is such a powerful idea now in Scotland, it's travelled to the islands, but it's not a simple reproduction, I don't think. I think it does change. And it changes because, I think, officers that living in close proximity with the communities changes the way that officers think about the people they encounter. And this is partly to do with power dynamics, but it's not just this. What islands do is they give officers a sense of the whole person. They don't just see someone when they're in trouble, like you would in a city, but you see people in and out at different stages of their life. You see them taking drugs, you see them getting better, you know their families. So I was struck by a story where Shetland officers told me they'd been dealing with a man who had taken psychoactive drugs and who was delirious and who, in their words, went wild, bit them and spat in their faces, and they had to pin him down 4 hours while the doctors tried to work out what he'd taken and what they should do. And the next day the officers were so sore they could barely walk, and one of them still got a bite mark on her leg. Now this is kind of classic police property stuff. You would expect this person to be highly stigmatised. And this is how the officers talked about him. He's a really nice lad. You see him walking about. He teaches karate. He's a black belt. I've seen him with his girlfriend. He looks healthy. And what's interesting about that is that it shows him after the event. They still see him. They still know who he is. And I think that's really significant because it seems to create a sense of understanding and empathy of the whole person. It's not just that you will see them again when you've lifted them, which you will, and it might be awkward, which it would, but it's about appreciation of what an officer described as their humanity, in that these people could be your family, and often was their family. You have to think everyone could be your mum, your dad, your auntie, your brother. So you've seen them through their life. And I was very interested in the kind of empathy and sensitivity that officers have in the way they talked about people that come up. What struck me most of all was what I can describe as a lack of disgust in comparison to the city policing that I've seen before, and respect for dignity. And it just seemed to me that this was importantly underpinned by a different way of thinking about people. And what this means is that the enforcement culture does travel. But I don't think it's a simple cloning or reproduction. There's no joy in giving out these tickets. It's got a very subtly different inflection. When people feel they have to give out tickets, they're given out infrequently, they're given out reluctantly, and unhappily, and with empathy. So I have been in numerous cars where we've caught a speeder, and we've given out a ticket, and people have sat in the car afterwards and said, well, I feel terrible. One occasion was to go back to the police station, because we all felt so terrible. The lady cried, we knew the lady. It was awful. And this is a kind of very subtle change, but I don't think that's unimportant. So there is another kind of aspect of culture here, which is, do new cultural phenomena appear somewhere like this? In other words, if we were starting from scratch and thinking about the police from here, what would we notice that shapes the way that officers think and how they act? And this is the final bit I want to talk about briefly. One of the most challenging ways of thinking about these complexities is thinking about the sky. Now, there is very little written about the sky in any humanities discipline. But as you move north, significance in its everyday life becomes absolutely unmistakable. You have these dramatic changes of light. You have the extraordinary phenomena. You have sunsets and moons and stars and auroras. This is, I've got a picture of the moon in Sheffield. That's at 2 a.m. Now, you have dramatic weather, you have storms and fogs and gales. I don't think this is just scenery to policing. I think this is a fundamental part of the way the police officers talk and think about their world. So, for example, we think about the importance and bits of police culture as it helps us to deal with unpredictability. We think about this in relation to people, the way they map their ground, the taking into account risk and danger. And when you move somewhere like this, other parts of police experience also become unpredictable and fundamental in the way that officers structure what they do, particularly the weather. If I take this ferry and the weather changes, I'm not going to be able to get back, so I'm not going to take this ferry. Very simple things like that. But it's much more significant. It changes the talk and the mood and the activities of what people do. So an accepted story in police, in at least in both areas, is that the moon has a direct effect on the public. This is one of the ways they map risk. This is in Stornoway police station. But officers' own behaviour changes as well. We spend hours driving out to the darkest places in the islands where you can best see the stars, where you can chase the red moons, where you pull over and you get out, you see the northern lights. But it also affects the way that officers understand where they are, and in particular this sense of remoteness. And when it's dark and there's cloud cover, officers talk about areas being claustrophobic and oppressive, and they avoid roads because of it, and they avoid whole areas because they're dark. They avoid areas which are talked about avoiding areas because they're bleak, because they're colourless. If you like grey, it's nice. The only colour you see is grey with a bit of brown. I hate this drive. Officers talk about colour a lot. It's a very prominent part of the way they talk about the land around them. And back to this idea of darkness. Darkness giving you a sort of existential sense of being alone. I felt like I was being swallowed by the island. I don't know if it was the darkness. Again, people who lived here don't understand darkness. Here there's nothing. So it becomes a fundamental part of their experience of structuring police action in the way that officers think about themselves and their world in it. So I think this is more than just scenery. I think it makes up the background noise of the way that officers think about their work and the people and the place where they are. So I just want to end on two points. Okay? The first is that I think that we have some limitations conceptually here. How do we think about this? This is about environment, it's not about people, it's not about things, but it's not about place as we think about it in criminology. It's not about observing or moving around space, it's about participating in it. This is a visceral experience. And I think the closest way I've come to, people have come to describing this, which makes sense to me, is in social anthropology, where people talk about emplacement. One of these ideas, people talk about emplacement with water, for example. That's quite similar. And there's an anthropologist called Tim Ingold, who's very interesting, who talks about the experience of light as an experience of being. He says it's about a body that's open and alive to the world. And I wonder whether, you know, one of the reasons why the sky and the light and the darkness is so affecting and so important is because it's an experience of being alive. You know, in any case, I think this is something more than thinking about place. But finally, more generally, what this suggests to me is that this is really a project about criminology. And what interests me is, why is our vocabulary about this stuff so limited? So why do we not notice those parts of experience about remoteness, fluidity, weather, sky, moon, darkness and light, and so on, and what it means to be in them? Particularly where they seem to be so important to the organisation of communities and social control. And I think that's got to be due to our own experience of the urban environment in which most of us think and write and research. And what I think it shows is that our thinking as criminologists is structured by place, even when we're not explicitly talking about place.